Welcome to the latest episode of Taking to the Street. This is Steve Weiss, and I'm sitting here with my good friend. I always stutter when I say that.
I've noticed that you stutter when you say that.
Or Farmer Jim. And again, this is the gift that keeps giving, this market with what's going on. We've got so much to talk about. And I would say that this is quite possibly one of the most important weeks that we've had in a very long time, and could set the direction not only short term, but intermediate term as well. And of course, what I'm talking about is the Fed getting together, the FOMC. The meeting starts tomorrow. We'll get a decision at 2 o'clock on Wednesday. And Wednesday, while the Fed is in meeting, we'll also get the PPI, which is, of course, the latest and a very important inflation forecast on top of the CPI, which is quite strong, that we got on Friday. So, Jim, why don't you kick off with what we're going to see this week and how you feel about it?
Steve, first off, it's good to see you. You are a good friend. It doesn't catch in my throat to say that. It's interesting. When I hear people say this is a very important week, I usually roll my eyes, because every week really has its own level of importance. But actually, I agree with you. This is an important week. It's not just the PPI, which should surprise nobody. We know inflation is here. It's hot. There's a question of how long it lasts. But the Fed is almost definitely going to increase its taper of bond purchases. And that means a lot for the stock market, because the facts are this. It has been 14 months since the stock market, as measured by the S&P 500, has had more than a 5% correction or drawdown, because correction means 10%. It has been longer than 14 months since the stock market, again, the S&P 500, has touched its 200-day moving average. Those two facts are an indication of how low volatility has been. It's my opinion that that low volatility is a gift from the Fed's bond buying program. And as that bond buying program now quickly ratchets down, I think we can expect volatility to pick up. I'm not expecting it to really pick up until the first quarter of next year, but let's face it, we're 3 weeks away. Whatever calming effects of people wanting to hang on to their gainers through year end or wanting to dress up their portfolio with winners, I think we can expect after this week to see heightened volatility.
I would say that we have seen heightened volatility already. It may not be apparent in the VIX itself, although we did see it get up to 30 at one point.
Before 35, 2 weeks ago.
Before trading back down to, 20, or maybe even breaking 20 into the teens. We've seen 1% moves, intraday 1% moves, down 1%, up 1%. So volatility has been there. I don't associate volatility with risk. It's generally opportunity. It's opportunity to sell or it's opportunity to buy, but it does make most investors nervous, particularly retail investors, but also institutional investors, where they're unnerved by the volatility, which, by the way, on a separate note, is why private equity does so well, because you don't have that volatility in a 10-year fund that gets marked to market every quarter, every 6 months, every year in real circumstances. However, this week and the week before is, and why somebody has to listen to us, because we've been saying for the last few weeks that the Fed will double the taper, take it from 15 to 30 billion. I was very clear about that last week, and I also believe they'll pull forward the rate hikes. Now, you and I disagreed about whether tapering is cutting off liquidity to the market or raising rates, essentially changing monetary policy. I feel very strongly, obviously, it's not raising the interest rates, even though the bond market may do that for you, practical interest rates, but it's cutting back liquidity into the market decidedly and presages the real firm move of raising rates. And that's what the market will look at. Now, you have to be sleeping under a rock and not be listening to Taking to the Street to not understand the Fed is going to be hawkish on Wednesday. And there's no reversing that. Not COVID.
They'd be crazy to reverse it at this point in time.
They'd have no credibility whatsoever.
I mean, at a time that their credibility is awfully darn low to begin with, it was, 15, 16 months ago that Powell said we're under a new paradigm. We're going to let inflation run hot. No, we're not. We're not going to let it run hot, because there's too much media and political pressure when that happens.
But they did. That was credible, because they did let it run hot. Too reversing, hot.
Well, not for very long, and they're reversing themselves. But I do agree they're doing the right thing. No need for us to rehash what is tightening, what is not tightening. I think what we will probably agree on is that the cessation, the taper of bond purchases, should not have a meaningful effect on the economy.
No.
It may have a meaningful effect on volatility, back to that in a second, but this isn't going to dampen the animal spirits within the economy that has CEOs and CFOs and boards of directors expanding their operations and doing things like supply chain onshoring and responding to infrastructure spending, all of which are positives going forward. Now, regarding the potential for a Fed rate hike, and I'll be honest with you, I'm not going to make a prediction. I see where the market is right now. It's somewhere between 2 and 3 rate hikes next year.
I like the fact you're not making a prediction because that will mean you'll be wrong one less time.
Well, if you make a prediction on this, you're almost certainly going to be wrong because predicting what the Fed does is really a fool's errand. They change their mind quite a bit. And frankly, the circumstances on which they base their decisions change. But I think the main point I'm trying to drive at here is the bull market in the stock market is not over.
Okay.
There may be volatility, but there's no reason to expect that earnings are going to go down, that you're looking at a recession. I mean, you've got a tremendous job market right now.
Right. Understood. But I mean, job market's part of it because that's very inflationary. Wages have to go up. But let's not talk about the future in the market because we have a bear market today.
It's a terrible day, Steve.
Not down 20% today, but it is down. And there are a lot of stocks that are down. And it's kind of troubling what is down. I take a look at retail. I take a look at Dick's Sporting Goods. I take a look at Target, which has slowly been trading down, down about 10% from the highs. And I say, wow, why Target? Now, the issue that I think you're seeing in the market today with bonds breaking, decisively breaking below 10-year, that is, below 1.5 yield, is that you've got the variant. You've got Omicron. And the issue is the Fed going to pursue a tightening policy while the economy may be weakening in the future because of the variant spreading? We're seeing closures of economies in Europe. We're seeing some of it in Asia. We're seeing massive spreading, even though the symptoms are small. So I think that's the concern, and that's what's driving stocks lower. We see it in the airline stocks that not all long ago said, oh, it's not an issue. And they were flying and the market was flying. So it's really difficult to understand what's taking the market lower. Is it the Fed program going forward? Or is it the variant? Such conflicting signals, because the Fed doesn't raise rates unless the economy's strong.
So let's start with this. Today in the stock market, and last I looked, the S&P 500 was down 65 basis points. Today in the stock market is a lot worse than that number.
Without a doubt.
And you alluded to it, but, and by the way, I'm going to talk about stocks. Assume that I own these stocks if you hear me talking about them, and please listen to the disclosures at the end. But look at a GM down 5%, okay?
So
look at a Wynn Resorts down 4%, and I could go on and on.
Dick's Sporting Goods down 10%.
Sure.
Why?
So, because of two things, and you've already mentioned them, so I'm just corroborating this. Omicron. It is worrying people what's going on in Europe. No question about that. It is also worrying people things like the mask mandate here in New York. It is on people's mind that maybe this is a slowdown. We're looking at something like 9% GDP growth here in the U.S. this quarter. Maybe people are worried about the first quarter of next year. If that's the case, I would have to say at this point, depending on how you count it, this is either the fourth or the fifth wave of COVID. Mm-hmm. We've gotten through it. The economy is continuing to expand and reopen, and we should expect that. If there's a first quarter slowdown, likely to be made up in the second quarter.
Don't people have memories? Don't they remember what happened, what the playbook was for the last time was much more severe when the entire world was shutting down and how we came out of that?
And we're not doing that. We're not shutting down.
Right. And if you sold your portfolio on the way down, then when did you get back in? You generated tax gains, assuming you had gains. However, I do think it is an opportunity, and I'm sitting with a large portion of cash in the portfolio because I've been getting rid of some positions, been cutting back on some positions over the last number of weeks. So I'm about 25-30% cash, and I'm not ready to put it in. If the market dumps on Wednesday, with Powell giving his press conference, then I'll start to blow some gap. But I'm seeing some compelling bargains there. I'm also still seeing some stocks that are way overbought or too highly valued, I should say.
So my mindset is a little different than yours. However, we're both talking about increasing volatility. My mindset, whether I'm right or wrong, is I've got a lot of gains. As annoyed as I am today, and Steve, I'm not going to beat around the bush, I am annoyed by the market today. It is very annoying to see these stocks down as much as they are. But I've got huge gains in them still. And so I'm looking at this and saying, is this a market into which I want to trim these stocks this late in the year? The answer is no. Am I right? Am I wrong? Time will tell. But what I do believe is going to happen is that, okay.
Why wouldn't you sell calls against the positions? Why wouldn't you buy puts on the positions?
Most of my clients are not within that sophistication factor. Now, I do have some clients who have very large positions in, say, Apple. A lot of people do. And I do write calls against Apple, sometimes Amazon. That does happen.
Scam protection, that's really pick up income.
It's to pick up income. You that's exactly right. But it's the same sort of situation of people have large embedded gains. They don't want to realize it. Right. And this is a way of getting some money out of it. But what I do think is going to happen, Steve, is sometime in the first quarter of this year, you're going to have a correction. By the way, folks, and by the way, Steve, I know how amateurish that sounds to predict a correction. I know that. Nonetheless, I have many years of experience, and I'm telling you, at some point in the first quarter, you're going to have a correction. I will be a little early. I'll be a little early in January, early January. I'll sell. I'll raise some cash, but not meaningful amounts of cash.
My point is you've already had a meaningful correction in so many stocks below the surface. The indices are one thing. The top line, even today, today's not an anomaly where the index is barely moving. The S&P I'll talk about now, down 65 bips. But we see a number of S&P components that are down substantially more today, or non-S&P components. The S&P is one thing. It's a benchmark, but it's not real life unless you're only an index investor. And then it is. But if you're a stock investor, to me, it's a useless benchmark. But I guess you have to do it. You have to have some sort of measure what you're against.
It's a way of
it's
referring.
Just not my it's, world.
Listen, I do understand what you're saying. It's a way of
I
referring to the market
returns.
I get you. Yeah. It's a way of referring to the market overall. But mm-hmm. let's go where you're going, and again, let's look underneath the markets. Last week, heard what you said. Okay, the S&P 500 was up 3.8%. There was one sector that was up more than the market last week. It was technology, up 6%. And this is leading to the right. question that you rhetorically asked me. Right now, I would not want to trim the Apples, the Qualcomms of the world. I want to let those things run, but those are the ones I will trim in early January. The flip side of which, to your point of, hey, these stocks have already gone down, I do not want to sell or even trim a General Motors or an Alaska Airlines or a Wynn Resorts right now. Not at these levels. I'm annoyed by these levels, but I am certainly not going to sell at these levels or even trim.
Big enough where you don't want to add.
I need some money. I need some money with which to add. I need to sell something in order to add. And it's going to be in January. What I will do is I will trim Apple. I've been public on that. I've been on the show. I think you've been
well,
with me.
Let's not talk about Apple. We've talked about Apple.
No. I'm using it as an example Except of a source of funds.
Right. But okay? let me talk about Apple just to
didn't
veer
you,
to
did
a different
Did you just
topic.
Say you didn't want to talk about Apple?
I did, but I'm not talking about Apple.
I think you
stock.
Wanted to. I think
I'm
what you meant to say was that you didn't want me to talk about Apple.
No, I said I didn't want you to talk about anything. I just want you to sit there and learn at my knee. Look, today we had J.P. Morgan come out with the highest price target on Apple at 210. We have Katie Huberty that has gone, always been a bull on it. Sometimes she takes her price target down 5 points. Sometimes she takes it up $5. It's just ridiculous. Now, J.P. Morgan finally raised their price target. And what motivates most analysts to raise their price targets is the fact that the stock's gone to their price target, so they now don't want to downgrade it. So it's the old street game. My advice is ignore analysts' price targets. Completely ignore them. They're good directionally, but don't base your investment on what an analyst has as a price target. First of all, Apple doesn't talk to anybody. They don't want their suppliers to talk to anybody, even though it'll leak out. It's not analyzable by any analyst, so it's pure folly. So with J.P. Morgan coming out the highest price target, if they were first, maybe they would have come out with 200. But in order to get on the map of investor, institutional investor awareness, they got to come out with the highest one. I used to work with an analyst, and this analyst would always be the highest price target on the street by a wide margin, 20%. I said, why do you do that, Chuck? He was an auto analyst, as it so happens. He said, because I wouldn't get the call. Because when people are voting for institutional investor, they're going to call the person with the highest numbers on the street and the person with the lowest numbers on the street and the one in the middle. I want to make sure I get that call. So that's why they do it.
Well, and by the way, there's a certain intelligence to being the high guy on the street because generally it pays to be a bull in the world that we live in. Yes, there are times that auto stocks will do absolutely terribly.
But that's not the point of it.
Well,
that's not the point.
I actually
want
to go back to what I was saying because I think you cut me off a little bit. I don't care about whether it's Apple or Qualcomm, but I do need to raise some funds. And what I will likely do early in January is raise some funds. Now, what are we talking about here, folks? And we've talked about this a few weeks ago. I'm not going wildly to cash.
Well, you can't with your client base. They're not paying you to manage cash for them.
Okay.
That
well,
they do themselves.
Well, I'm not, but boy, you just don't want to make this point, do you?
Well, because you made it. You made it every week. So we don't need to make it today, but go ahead.
All right. Listen, there is going to be opportunities. This is to your point about volatility. It is opportunities. You do have to hold your clients' hands in my business. And if you've sold something with which you have a gain and you can say, listen, we took a little money off the table, it helps people. So when we get into early 2022, look at these technology stocks that have shot the lights out. You can take some money off the table. It's okay.
I don't think there's any need to, just like predicting the Fed, I don't think there's any need to predict what you're going to do in January. You'll address it when January comes. Because if the market is down 10%, then, or those stocks are down 10 or 20%, you may be sitting there. So to say, I've got in my calendar, I'm selling Qualcomm.
No, you listen, you're right. You're right.
Whatever.
If January were today, but it's not. I got you.
Yeah, it's a useless exercise. But I want to talk about one more street move today in a stock that I own, which I had sold some of it because it was up so much in just a few months. It was up about 80%, but still a large core position. GXO Logistics. GXO is a unique company. It's the only publicly traded pure logistics company out there. It was spun out of XPO. The reason I mention it today is stock's down from its highs of about 100, I think it was. It's down to the mid-80s. An analyst, firm will go unnamed because they're not here to defend the call. They downgraded the stock from a buy to a hold on Friday. Stock was down 8%. It was down basically on insider selling. Insiders sell all the time. If you had sold an insider selling on Moderna, you would have sold stock at 50, as a lot of people did because of insider selling, and not have owned it through this run.
Real quick aside here, yeah. All right? There's also a lot of insider selling because of the possibility significant tax law changes next year.
Exactly right.
So there is no question that, I mean, look, you look at Satya Nadella, you look at Elon Musk, these guys are selling major portions of their holdings, most likely for that reason.
Right. So the stock traded down. Now, the individual still owns a lot of stock. Stock traded down 8% on that. I don't think so much on the downgrade. It's sort of like a second or third tier firm. The analyst came out today and upgraded the stock on it being cheap.
One day later.
Downgrade Friday, upgrade today. I'd be embarrassed to do that.
I don't like that. I don't like that at all.
It's crazy. It's ridiculous.
You're just blowing whichever way the wind
takes you. And the price target the analyst had was meaningfully above where the stock was. So
now,
there's another 10%
with
upside.
Your history with investment research, is that the sort of move that caters to retail or to hedge funds or to neither?
It doesn't cater to hedge funds because hedge funds aren't following this person. Hedge funds don't follow analysts.
Steve, you don't have to be mad at me. I'm asking you, I'm inquiring of you.
There's only so much knowledge I can impart during one time, so I'm honoring you with an inquiry.
All right? Yeah, be flattered.
Hedge funds get too much credit and they get too much blame. And this is not a good call for a hedge fund. If a hedge fund was short the stock, sure, they'll make money on it. When they downgrade on Friday, even though, as I said, I don't believe it was that analyst downgrade that got the stock down. If a hedge fund's long it, it'll go up. Just like anybody else, I could tell you that long only's benefit because they got an opportunity to buy it 8% cheaper on Friday and would immediately reward it today. And today the stock is flat. It was up a little, now it's flat, which is great performance today. So hedge funds, they don't care. They're the last ones to list analysts, frankly.
Yeah. We didn't really quite finish the Fed discussion. I know we're in individual stocks, but I want to jump back there for a second because you said something about the Fed only raises rates in a strong economy. And generally that's true. But what the bond market is saying right now is not that. What the bond market is saying right now with the 10-year being down another 6 basis points today to 142, it is saying that the Fed is likely to make a mistake by getting too aggressive and basically killing the economy.
But you know what? I don't know if that is because if rates coming down, part of it's undoubtedly that. But it also may be the fact that our 10-year yield, even a 145, is still a better yield than you can get just about anywhere else in this market. And definitely the highest yield you can get in a deep market.
So, and when you say anywhere, you mean in terms of other sovereign bonds around the world.
Other sovereign bonds, yeah. Right. So I think that that's part of it. And if you take a look at the auctions, the recent auctions, whether it's a 2-year, 10-year, 7-year, 30-year, they've all been pretty strong with the exception of one. So there's a lot of appetite for our paper still.
There's a hidden reason for that, Steve, and nobody is talking about this. Actually, the deficit at the federal level has been improving more rapidly than people realize. And the Build Back Better bill has been pushed off, so that hasn't exacerbated it. But basically, supply has been drying up in terms of, and when I say supply, I mean supply after the Fed buys its portion of the bonds that it buys. That's a reason why the 10-year is, right. But is down in yield, up in price.
Here's an interesting fact for you. In the last 55 years, there's only one period where both the bond market and the equity market have been down. They generally move up together. And this could be the first year in a long time where bonds could be down, yields up, and the equity market's up. And then there are concerns of an inverted yield curve. And an inverted yield curve have predicted the last 50 of the last 29 recessions. So it is somewhat of an indicator, but it's not a definitive call that, oh no, inverted yield curve is going to take the market and the economy lower. It's not necessarily presaging that.
I'd like to see higher interest rates. For a lot of reasons. I'd like to see savers properly compensated, which they are not.
But in an orderly fashion.
In an orderly fashion. In an orderly fashion.
And markets do go up, rates go up. But
I'd also like to see some of the excesses in the markets flushed out. And yes, that's a segue. Did you take a look at the price of Bitcoin today?
Yes, I did.
Below 47,000? I guess I shouldn't chuckle, whether it was last week or 2 weeks ago.
Don't chuckle too loudly.
Oh, 2 weeks ago, we were negative on it. You were with
me on that. No, what I said was it's a legitimate speculative asset class, because it is. Doesn't need me to define that. It will not and never be a currency. Can you imagine if that's how you paid for your cars and you go into a car dealer, you say, hey, I'm paying Bitcoin. And they say, okay, great. Car's 20,000 while it's staying there. Oh no, it's 21,000 now because you're paying Bitcoin. Your Bitcoin declined.
I think there is one threat that nobody really talks about within cryptocurrencies, and that's that the central banks just developed their own cryptocurrencies.
Well, they are.
That's exactly right. But nobody's really taking that as a serious threat.
Yes or no? Well, I'll tell you why they don't. Because they look at crypto as the anti-government play. So they're still going to, you'll have that core. I don't think it's enough, though. And then the other story in Bitcoin is, or crypto, that it's such great technology. But truth is, you don't need crypto to have blockchain technology.
Exactly.
I never understood that argument, that I own it for the technology. What technology? Now, how much are you willing to pay for that technology?
And also the fact that there are thousands of cryptocurrencies out there tells you that that technology is not particularly unique or special. And it's not just the central banks that are going to develop it as well. Visa and MasterCard are looking at this. They'll probably develop it as well.
Facebook was doing Libra.
I think Facebook's on hold with that, though.
Well, they're on hold with everything. They're on hold with their acquisitions. They're on hold with quite a bit, except for name changes. But it's been a great stock recently. I was going to sell all my position, but I only sold half of it when the whistleblower started testifying. And I said, I'll sell the next part. It'll lift. It didn't lift. It went down. So I was able to buy back and actually create a full position again, much lower. But that's why I'd like to get out of it at some point.
I think you should. I don't own it. I see the valuation, which is actually compelling, but they do horrible things.
Whistleblower, I think that's overstated. But you know,
I don't think so.
I think some of it's overstated. And here's why. Sure, a 14-year-old girl getting depressed looking on Facebook and seeing pictures of others. There's nothing you do about that.
Instagram is where they're.
Yeah, Instagram or Facebook photos. What can you do about that? You can't have thin people say you can't be on Instagram. So it's a question of parents regulating screen time. This is a whole different debate, obviously. But if they don't see it there, they'll see it in, if they bring back print magazines, they'll see it on TV shows. They do. So I'm not defending the company. I think management is one of the more arrogant managements out there. But I also believe that they put up good product for the most part.
I will enjoy it. I will extend my comment by saying it's not just Facebook. It's social media in general. I'm no fan of Twitter either. You and I are on Twitter. We're pretty active on it. Some of the crap that comes into my timeline.
I'm not a fan of the people, a lot of the people that are on it.
Exactly. It's a cesspool.
I can't criticize the company because they do what they can. It's impossible to regulate.
Obviously, we talk about finance here. We talk about the worth of stocks, trying to find ones that are undervalued that we can buy, ones that are overvalued that we can sell. But there is an element of humanity to this as well. I just have to say, I think social media platforms are terrible for humanity. I think it brings out the worst of people.
Society, get rid of MSNBC, get rid of Fox, and we'll be in a better place to begin with. Get rid of this fringe, get rid of the ones that cater to the fringe, and bring the conversation back to the middle. And
all right.
Hold people accountable for truth. But let's move on to a different topic. So this week, let's say the Fed comes out and they say, okay, we are doubling down. It's going to be $30 billion a month and gives you visibility without declaring it, because they won't do that you feel that there's going to be a rate hike call it May. What do you think the market does?
I think the market, if you closed your eyes, got on a spaceship and orbited the Earth for the next year, I think you would come back and say, hey, my stocks did pretty darn well.
What do you think it does pretty well. Wednesday afternoon, Thursday. Tough call.
It's a tough call, but you know what? Probably negative, maybe for a day or two, like it was 2 weeks ago when he was testifying in front of Congress. It was kind of negative until the Friday of that week, and it came back, and it had quite the rally last week as well, set a new high. So this is just volatility, and you already said it, I'll corroborate you, that volatility is opportunity. But for people like me with individual clients, it's a lot of handholding. It's a lot of calls of,
hey, I'm holding my own
hand. Hey, Mrs. McGillicuddy, it's okay. It's okay. We're going to be okay. Actually, by this point in time, most of my clients know me and I know them, and we know to just buckle our seatbelts. And by the way, if you take a look at a 100-year chart of the S&P 500, the world has yet to end, despite many prognostications that it will.
You'd be hard-pressed in a 100-year chart to actually find where it went down at any point in time, because the trend is it's up. It's going to continue
to be up.
Yeah, that is my point.
I get it. I actually want to come back to you on something, though. I deferred on this question earlier, but I want to make this statement. I don't think the Fed is going to be in any hurry to raise interest rates. They are going to be in a hurry to taper bond purchases. There's a few reasons for that. One, it's an emergency policy, and there is no emergency in the economy right now. Or if there is, it's inflation, which is not going to be helped by continuing to purchase bonds. Two, political pressure is extraordinary right now to get the bond tapering done. So they're going to do that. But I don't think the Fed is in any hurry to raise interest rates. No. I think this chairman was badly scarred in the fourth quarter of 2018 when he got aggressive. He said, we're a long way from the neutral rate. And the stock market said, oh, no, we're not. We're at neutral rate right now. And he pivoted by the end of the quarter.
And that's a good point, because while he reversed on that, he can't reverse again. So that's why they may go slower. However, I do think they put the message out that they're going to do it. And that's been out there already, that they're going to pull forward. That was in the last minutes. But if your rationale for cutting back on the bond buying is because those are emergency measures and we're not in the emergency anymore, by the way, so are rates where they are, below what has normally been before this cycle of 3% Fed funds. And here we are at basically free money. So they should get there under your analysis, but they won't, because the wrong thing to do is to raise them quickly. That's the velocity of the raise.
That is the level. Exactly the point. And I am hearing people, and you are too, are saying, okay, they'll taper, they'll be done in March, and they'll raise in April. Maybe they are done with the taper in March. I don't think their next move, the next month, is to raise rates, unless, and here's where I could be wrong, inflation really does stay at this level or get worse. Now, I don't think that's going to happen, and I'm throwing caution to the wind by making a prediction like this, but you and our viewers want to hear this.
I was looking at the Broncos, Ford Bronco. And I went online because my daughter's lease is up, look for a new car. 26-week wait.
But that'll go away.
That's part of demand, is my point, not just supply chain. Supply chain, we talked about this last time. My view is it hasn't really gotten better. Your view is that it is, because you're seeing some chips come to GM.
I think you're also seeing things. And look, I know I'm being incautious in saying this, all right? I realize it's early, but still, it is today, Steve.
That's what they taught you. Princeton?
Yes, that's what they taught me. In my first semester, I had a vocab course, vocab 101.
Here are the words you should never use, incautious, or make your own.
All right, we're moving on, you goofball. Container dwell time at the Port of Los Angeles, Long Beach. Now, this is only one element of the supply chain bottleneck. Yes, we know about chassis shortages. Yes, we know about regulatory pollution requirements on the trucks and how they can get in there. And yes, we know about union requirements. But container dwell time is down 37% from its peak just a few weeks ago. It's a step in the right direction. You're going to tell me about the ships being moved offshore. We know that. It's a fact. That's probably the last metric that will improve. You got to get the containers out of the port first.
Agreed. Hey, it will get better. It will get better, and it may get better.
I'm glad to hear you agree with that, because I think there is a level of hysteria in the markets right now regarding inflation that says, no, it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse. And that's where I'm saying, I think the media is getting it wrong. I think you're at the point where you're seeing freight prices roll over, container leasing prices roll over, these dwell times go down.
Commodity prices have been rolling over for a while, certain commodities. Kind of troubling, actually. Because they were up on
the
air.
They were up pretty high.
They were on air with no support.
And by the way, since you're going there, I have to say, have you taken a look at lumber prices?
I have not. I'm not involved, so I have not.
They started to bounce right back up. Last 3 or 4 weeks, they're up about 50, 60%. That's a little odd. It's something to keep your eye on. You know, there's a lot of cross currents here, right? We see steel prices starting to come down. Mm-hmm. You see oil is down. Now, that's down on the perception that Omicron is going to, at least for the next quarter, dampen demand. Okay, maybe it does, but then it'll pick back up again.
And also OPEC basically said they're going to pump. They're not going to penalize the countries for releasing their reserves.
Although they left themselves a pretty open door to reverse that.
They always do. I'm just not, the only real commodity stock I own is Cleveland Cliffs, which you would argue is fully integrated, but we don't have to discuss that story. That can't get out of its own way like so many other stocks.
They bought back a deep in the money convert last week, which is basically a share buyback.
Right,
I mean, those shares are in the diluted share count. And I only bring that up. This doesn't have to be specific about Cleveland Cliffs. I actually want to make a bigger point here. Share buybacks are increasing. We're looking like we're certainly going to set a record this year. And if I look particularly in the healthcare space the last week, you've seen Bristol Myers today raise its dividend and increase its share buyback. Last week, CVS increased its dividend and initiated.
Those aren't news stories. We've seen, maybe with those stocks, but we've seen buybacks hit record levels so many times over the last number of years.
And I think you're jumping in before I make my point, which is I'll make it quick.
Okay.
Free cash flow is high and looks stable. Regardless of margin pressures, regardless of commodity prices, wage prices, you don't do these things. You don't raise dividends and announce buybacks unless you're comfortable with your projections going forward.
I wish that IBM thought that when they bought their stock back and went upside down their balance sheet many years ago. And I know you're not involved in the stock. I'm not bringing up that. The point is that companies do things for different reasons. And while you hope they're responsible, you have much greater faith in them than I do in terms of that. Sometimes they do it for a message. Sometimes they do it because they want the balance sheet flexibility, and they have it in terms of the convert, in terms of debt. But there are many different reasons for doing it. But the point is a good one, that buybacks.
Can I dance with what you're saying?
Sure.
Because I've heard that before. You've heard it before, that one of the lousiest deciders of what price to pay are companies when they're buying back shares. And you bring up IBM. I'm certainly reminded of the energy stocks in the early 2010s, buying back a lot of shares just in time for oil to go from 150 to 25. But I do feel, Steve, like in a lot of cases, not all cases, that's a bit of a canard. And the reason that I say that is I look at certain companies, not all of them, but certain companies where their share counts really decline dramatically. I bring up Apple again. Last 6 years, it's shrunk its share count by 25%.
Great.
Same thing at Citigroup, by the way. And the point being is that these buybacks have an impact.
No, of course they do. They shrink the share base. So if you earn X dollars, that X number of dollars is divided over a few number of shares. So your PE looks more attractive.
But I like that is what I'm saying.
It's fine.
If I'm a long-term holder, this is Warren Buffett's point. If I'm a long-term holder, which I generally am, I don't always get it right. Sometimes I've got to vacate a stock early because it doesn't work out. But if I'm a long-term holder, I want those earnings more concentrated in my shares.
Of course you do. Of course, there's no argument there. My point is that we've heard this, that, oh, the market's only going up because share buybacks, it's the main thing. You're not saying that, but we've said it so many times over the past. Large share buybacks, record-setting share buybacks are not something new. We've seen record set of last 5 years or so. And yes, it has helped the market. We have 50% fewer equities out there because of M&A than
we
did
15
years ago.
You went right where I wanted to go. So shares are being bought back, whether it's by companies or through acquisitions. And yet at the same time, there are IPOs that go on. So as you and I, or I'll just take me, I can be a holder of Marathon Petroleum, which is buying back a third of its shares outstanding over the next 18 months. Or I can go out and own more shares of an IPO that comes out with no earnings and valued at 40 times sales that are going to be reached maybe in 5 years. I'll take Marathon Petroleum
That's a different investment discipline. Somebody else does quite well with the investment discipline of buying the high growth, highly valued stocks. Somebody else like you is a value
player. Not this year, they don't.
Well, it depends. Depends what you own. Some have. It depends.
Roku.
If you bought and sold at the right point, Snowflake, if you bought it on the IPO, you're selling it now. I mean, pick them. CrowdStrike, yeah, it's down quite
Palantir.
A bit. Could have bought it. I never bought into the Palantir story.
I know you didn't. I don't know why you're arguing with me. You're
I'm just saying you have to be respectful that your investment discipline is not the only one out there, not the only one to make money.
You always have to be respectful. It's a very good point. You have to be respectful.
I'm always
of
the voice
people's.
Of reason, Jim. Don't you know that?
People know you
this
as the respectful.
This is Zen-like Steve.
Yes. Okay? Respectful is your middle name.
Right. It is. It is. But let's talk about Disney for a second. So you've been an owner of Disney. I bought a trading position last week. Look like a hero for a day. And I no longer feel superhuman on that. The stocks come down as we've seen closures, as we've seen mask mandates, vaccine mandates, and which, by the way, I'm in favor of, but we don't have to get political. But the stock just keeps going lower. And until you really open the economy and people aren't afraid to go out, I think you could be troubled.
So I'm in it for a little over a year. Bought it shortly after the pandemic really hit. So late in 2020. And I enjoyed that rise, particularly in December when they came out with this wonderful projection for Disney Plus. And then it fizzled from March. Started to climb back a little bit. And then they had a bad quarter. Okay, a bad quarter. Now, here's the point I would really make. You are talking appropriately about the impact of the virus Omicron on perhaps reversing the reopening, perhaps reversing the number of people who are willing to go to theme parks or go to movie studios or whatever. That may or may not be the case. We don't know just yet. But what I will put to you is that I think it is a huge head fake to think that whatever Omicron's effect is going to be, that it's going to last for very long. I don't think it will. I think your buddies at Moderna, all of our pals at Pfizer, are working on boosters and new vaccines that are going to take care of this thing pretty quickly, as well as treatments. And there's a pretty large likelihood, Steve, that the link between case count and mortality really breaks down going forward.
Well, it has been because so far, by all accounts, this is not as severe.
And if people are dying,
keep you laid up. But as far as Disney goes, it's no longer such a clean story that it was with their streaming, which has been basically a money sink. So if you don't have the cash flows coming from the parks, then you aren't able to as appropriately support those businesses unless you want to incur more debt. And I will tell you that Steven Spielberg had West Side Story, and that opened to $11 million in ticket sales. A disastrous opening. Is because nobody likes Steven Spielberg, most successful producer of all time? No, it's because people don't want to go out to movie theaters. Now, bars and restaurants are an issue. Try and get a reservation, and you'll pay for any meal with your lungs. The inflation is just unbelievable. But there are certain things that the public's not just going to take a chance on.
I'm not sure I'm making the point clearly enough, but I think the world wants to move past this virus.
Of course.
And particularly if the mortality breaks away from and is markedly less than the infection rate, then this is, all right, it sucks. You get this virus, you get a cold, it's terrible, but you don't die. And that's a big game changer. But you know, with regards to Disney,
you don't die doesn't mean you don't get very sick. It doesn't mean that you don't infect your kids. Doesn't mean you don't infect
Getting the flu sucks.
This potentially less severe than what? Less severe than death. But still, you can get severe symptoms.
Okay, but I don't think that this is going to have the effect on the economy that people fear it does. I do want to go back to what you said, though, about Disney with cash flows. Last I checked, they had $26 billion in cash on the balance sheet. I don't think they're going to be raising debt anytime soon.
They had raised a lot of debt.
Well, that's how they have $26 billion of cash on the balance sheet.
Exactly.
You're talking about having to raise more if the theme parks don't.
Yeah, which is a different story.
Steve, what you're talking about, what you said, don't make me get mad at you.
I'm not saying they're going to have to go out and raise more cash.
Okay, that's what it sounded like you were saying.
I'm saying that if the theme parks aren't producing the cash flow, then their debt repayment, they're going to pay their debt. I'm not saying, I'm not raising alarm bells here, calling fire in a crowded theater. I'm just saying that without that cash flow, it may instruct how they do certain things. Content production, they need to produce a lot more content. They just can't rely on the library.
They are. And it doesn't
seem... It costs lots of money.
Yeah. Here's the thing. Number one, doesn't seem to be stressing out their balance sheet, number one. Number two, the growth in the streaming subscriber counts is really quite remarkable. I think at the last end of the quarter, they were at 118 million. That's from pretty much a standing start about 2 years ago.
They gave it away to so many. I got Disney Plus for free.
You get it free for a year from Verizon, then you got to start paying for it.
Then I'm not. I'm not renewing.
Okay, well, then there's 117,999,999 subscribers now. That's that fine. Now that you've cut your Disney Plus.
If I had young kids, I would renew. I don't. My point is that you have two different businesses. You have the streaming business where they're losing money, and you have the other business which is cash flow positive. So what do you value it on? Do you value it on an EBITDA multiple? That seems that that's the way it should go. It used to be a PE. But it's too high for the PE's too high now.
It's a valuation challenge right now. There's no question about it.
Which is the point.
But it's because it's in a recovery mode. It is, particularly on the theme parks. But it's also in a growth mode on this Disney Plus, which, look, they had a bad quarter. Their last quarter was a bad quarter in terms of subscriber count. There were explanations for it.
Lots of people weren't getting it for free anymore.
It was a lot of international turnover and a change in the ARPU there. Every indication is that quarter was an anomaly. Hey, we'll talk about this in 2 months. We'll see what the fourth quarter numbers are. Actually, for them, I believe it's the first quarter. We'll talk about it. We'll see if it ramps back up. I think when we talk about it losing money, right now they're predicting profitability in 2024. Now, this is important. Let's dissect this for a second. A year ago, they were predicting profitability in 2024. But what's changed in the last 12 months is they've actually increased the capital spend that they're making on content, which tells us that they actually could be profitable in 2023 if they weren't spending on content. And what it tells me, Steve, is they're actually doing better than they expected. And I wouldn't be surprised if profitability for Disney Plus were to come in 2023. It's not that far away.
Okay, let's move on for Disney because you really get under my skin because it's a basic story. You're trying to make it something so complicated.
You know what you need to do? You need to re-up your Disney Plus and watch a movie like The Little Mermaid. Just something to make you feel good.
Yeah. We have different tastes like that.
I know.
I just watched True Story on Netflix with Kevin Hart, and that was phenomenal. I'd recommend that. They're just a tremendous series. The guy is so good.
I'm going to send you a Christmas gift of The Little Mermaid. On Blu-ray.
I don't want you to deplete your library. So, thank you. I'm going to send it to you. Hold on to it so you and your wife can cuddle up on the couch.
I'm going to send it to you on Betamax cassette.
Okay, you do that. So let's see. I think we're coming near to the end of it. We've shared so much information today.
Oh, God.
In terms of stocks, look, I'll tell you, my shopping list is adding back to GXO, adding back to XPO. I may wait for the quarter. I have a decent-sized position, but they had labor issues. I've sold down half of my FedEx because I just don't have confidence in management that they're going to be able to. I don't see a big change from the last quarter in terms of the labor shortage they had to conquer and basically the massive pipeline they have of freight where it's just 100% booked all the time. And it hurts their margins if they have to outsource or if they have to take assets, their own assets, away from more of the profitable business for the less profitable business, which is ground.
Well, listen, that's been your baby.
I wouldn't call it my baby. I'd call it a great position at one point that was never a big position. It only got big as I kept buying it when it was falling.
We're going to talk next Monday. And you know what's going to be in the rearview mirror that we get to discuss? FedEx earnings.
Yes. They report on Thursday.
Yeah. What do you think? What do you think is going to happen? Give it to us.
Well, a number of analysts have said they're going to miss on the bottom line. Maybe that's in the market. Maybe it's not. I think they disappoint. I think the top line's fine. How could it not be?
You're sticking with it, though. Is it already in the price that they're going to disappoint? I mean, it's not. Listen, all kidding aside, it hasn't been fun, right?
No, tell us what you're doing. I'm just about even the position underwater a little bit because I bought so much down when it broke 220, 219. I just thought that was ridiculous. I don't know if I'll be there when they report this on Thursday, to be honest with you.
You heard it here first, folks.
Yeah, I've cut back the position quite a bit.
You heard it here first.
So we'll see. Right. I mean, how much do I need? I've got GXO, I got XPO, I got FedEx. I don't need them.
I would agree with you.
If I do it over again, and Mulligan's always great investing, you don't get them, but I wouldn't own all three of them. And UPS, which was not as well managed a company, has held up much better.
It has. I'm in neither.
Yield helps that, of course. Yeah.
They've actually got some union issues, some contract issues there at UPS to deal with.
Well, it was always non-union until it became union. Who doesn't? Deere had them.
GM had them 3 years ago.
Yeah, those are the unions. Yeah. So unions have tried to make comeback in power.
You know, I went to my GM dealer on Saturday, signed up for the Lyriq, the Cadillac electric vehicle, electric SUV. I'm kind of excited for that. I'll take you for a ride. It'll make you look good.
We'd have to get into car together. No, that's not going to happen, Jim.
I'll strap you to the roof.
But thank you for the offer. We won't be doing that anytime soon. When do they say you get delivery?
I don't know, actually. That was a head scratcher. Didn't get a good answer there.
But it's available. It's out there now, right?
No. They're still developing it.
They're still developing
it. It should be next year, but I don't know when.
I saw a video on it. It looked like a really nice car.
No, not yet. It is a pretty car. We'll take it. We'll go play some golf together. We'll look good. You know, I'll make you look good.
My wife says
it's a hard task, but I'll do it.
My wife says, if you ever buy a Cadillac or a Lincoln, I'm going to divorce you.
She literally said that?
You'll be too old for me.
I've met your wife. She's a heck of a lot nicer than that. Of course, she's a heck of a lot nicer than you.
No, she has said that in jest. She said, those are old people's cars, don't you know? And they're nice, but I think it's fitting. I'd see you with your chinos, your yellow button-down shirt.
Chinos? Who uses the word chino?
Chinos, khakis. Are those saddle shoes? Wow, they're making a comeback.
They're blue suede shoes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay.
They are, literally.
All right. Well, I think this is an appropriate note to, because I'm about to lose my lunch here. So I think this is an appropriate time to sign off. Any final words, Jim?
Hang in there, folks. Don't get thrown by volatility. It's going to come. Steve, this is important. There will be a 10% correction and people are going to be running around like their hair is on fire. Don't worry about it, folks. You'll get through it.
It always feels so bad when it's happening.
It does.
Like it's going to go down another 10%, another 20%. And best thing is just to not look.
Exactly. Don't try to time it. Don't think you're smarter than everybody. You're going to get out. You're going to get in. Yeah, Steve and I may make some trims along the way here, some ads, and we'll do our best, but we're not making large moves in and out of the market.
No, but what I do, I'm short the SMH, I'm short the triple Qs, so those are helping a little bit today. I do look for the fat premium in options and in calls primarily to sell them. In puts, I look for no premium, so I constantly have to roll my puts, but like on Moderna, I buy puts on Moderna periodically and I sell calls on it, but I do in other stocks I'm not even involved in.
You give us the final wrap-up.
The final wrap-up is, look, it's going to be potentially a rough week with today just being the first part of it. So I would just hold tight and use it as an opportunity because the market then can turn around and rally seasonally into month end.
The bull market is intact.
I think largely the trend is there's always a bull market. All right, Jim. Till next week.
Till next week. Good to see you, Steve.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
I can't believe those words came out of my mouth, but yeah, they did. Good to see you, Steve.
Neither. All right.
Jim Labenthal is an investment advisor representative of Cerity Partners and holds the Chartered Financial Analyst designation. Jim Labenthal and Cerity Partners are unaffiliated with Stephen Weiss. The securities discussed in this podcast by Jim, unless otherwise stated to the contrary, are securities that Jim either manages within the current client portfolios or owned by Jim personally. You should not consider the information discussed as personalized investment, tax, or legal advice, or solicitation to buy or sell any specific security. There's no guarantee that views and opinions expressed in this podcast will come to pass or a guarantee of future performance. Investing involves risk, and before investing, you should consult a qualified professional advisor. Stephen Weiss is not a registered investment advisor and is not affiliated with any regulated entity. The views and opinions he expresses are his own and are not intended to be advice or recommendations. Stephen does not guarantee the accuracy of his statements or views. Investors should perform their own due diligence and not rely upon the information contained in this podcast as the sole basis for their investments.